time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 693 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I talk with Stefan Frank, an acclaimed cartoonist and award-nominated animator, writer, and director. He has a Kickstarter underway for both Romance in the Age of the Space God and Palomino. Stefan is quite the accomplished creator, and his Kickstarter is for a standalone graphic novella called Romance in the Age of the Space God and his Ringo Award-nominated crime mystery, Palomino. Here's how both are described. Part sci-fi thriller, part slice of life, and part political satire, Romance in the Age of the Space God drops us into a world not unlike ours, where things once thought impossible have happened. Also a captivating neo-noir crime mystery, Palomino begins in 1981 Los Angeles, where we meet Eddie Lang, an old-school, hard-boiled former Burbank PD detective, juggling his six-nights-a-week gig at the Palomino house band, his PI business, and his teenage daughter, who might even be more hard-boiled than he is. We explore both creations, who the various characters are, how the stories came to be, and also talk about an important project I'm particularly fond of that Stefan helped bring to the big screen. Be sure you back this excellent comics project before it concludes on Monday, June 6th at 2:59 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. Dark Planet Comics 2025 graphic novels by Stefan Frank includes the Romance in the Age of the Space God standalone graphic novella and the return of the Ringo Award nominee crime mystery Palomino. And I'm talking today with said creator, Stefan. How you doing, Stefan?
I'm doing great, Wayne. How are you?
Good. It's good to talk with you. As we were talking before we started to record, Dark Planet Comics has had, about seven? I guess this must be the eighth Kickstarter you guys are doing. So you're getting decent at it by now.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like every campaign is different. You know, the times are different. You know, the economy is different every time. So you honestly never know what to expect. But so far, it's been successful, you know.
That's good. That's good. Let's see here. Whenever there's two, I always try to figure which one we should go to first. I got a chance to read Romance in the Age of the Space God, so why don't we start with that, and then we'll get to Palomino after that.
Yes, that's great.
Okay, a little description here. It says, the campaign will introduce new readers to Romance in the Age of the Space God, a hyper-timely dystopian sci-fi comic that Frank quietly published last year with a super limited edition 150-copy print run. And also includes the two volumes of Palomino. So how would you describe Romance in the Age of a Space God to people who may not know what it is?
Well, you know, typically I do, you know, most of my series are long series. So it's always long form, like a big sort of novel, you know. But I always love short stories. And sometime during the pandemic, like in the madness of the pandemic, you know, like there was like this... there was this urge to do something about our times. You know, I call it a weird comic about our times, about weird times, you know. And it's so it's a 44-page one-shot, you know, that you can think of it as an open-ended short story, or it could be the first chapter of a long series. Who knows? We'll see. But it's really fun as a short story. And so it's like part dystopian sci-fi thriller, part slice of life, because everything I do has a lot of slice of life. You know, I like stuff that feels really lived in, where you really get into like a lot of immediacy in the life of the characters. And there's even some political satire in it. But it's a really fun window on the world. And the kicker is, for maximum sort of cognitive dissonance, it's done all with like adorable little mice, you know. Imagine like a classic anthropomorphic mice, you know, but in this sci-fi thriller, you know. It's a super, super fun story. And I think it really boils down to like this theme that I think is very present these days, where we all feel like the world is broken in many ways, you know, but yet people still have to live. People have, you know, to have purpose, have ambition, have to fall in love, you know. So how to find your meaning and your purpose in a broken world, I think, is a question that exists in the back of everybody's mind, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me read a little bit of the introduction that's on the book, because I think it's really good. It says, "Romance in the Age of the Space God is a window on a world," you were talking about. "It's a world in trouble, to be sure, a world that's allowed itself to flirt with disaster for a little too long and is now degraded, a world in erosion in which the hallowed out trappings of civil society remain in place, merely existing as a maze for people to stumble through. Yet it is a world in which people will be people. Ego, ambition, love, a sense of justice. These are the timeless emotions animating our characters as they search for meaning in their broken world." And then you go right into a question I wanted to ask. It says, "And then there is the space god. What is it? What does it want? Is it here to judge us, to rule us, to end us, to enlighten all of us, or maybe just a select few? Or does it want nothing at all, its inescapable presence, an inscrutable void for people to protect their existential struggles into?" And, of course, I'm not sure that question ever gets completely answered, but it does make for – when I came away from this book, the thing I thought the most was that you were trying to get those of us who read it to think.
Yeah, I mean, to me, to give people context, right? The space god is this strange object, this giant. It almost looks like an egg, but it's all kind of, you know, it's all black. And, you know, it was found on the encrusted inside one of the moons of Saturn. And then all of a sudden, we don't know exactly how, we don't say how in the short story, but now it's in Earth orbit, you know. So it's there, it's present in the sky, and it's got this really weird property that it looks, you can see it at all times from anywhere in the world. It always looks like it's above you, you know what I mean? So there's this world breaking, you know, object is there now, and everybody need to make sense of it, you know. And some people will accept it as their new god. Some people will see it as a sign of doom. Some people will think it's business as usual, you know. And it's a symbol for, you know, the fact that, you know, one of the first lines in the story, when the main character is talking, is saying that something that always felt weird to him in superhero movies is that like big giant world events happen that should shatter your reality. And, you know, it gets sort of solved or not. And next thing you know, people like continue, just carry on as if, you know, this is just the new normal or nothing happened. And, you know, he says, you know, that didn't ring true to me. Well, I stand corrected, right? And so I think anyone who's, I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, you know, and we're seeing things happen in the world in the last, you know, few years that, you know, are straight out of dystopian sci-fi stuff we never thought we'd see in our lifetime, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, from tech to politics to, you know, many, just, you could go down the list, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, what is the space god, right? So like either, you know, I do in my mind know what it is, but I'm not going to spoil it in case we continue the story. And if we leave it at this short story, then it will be this metaphor, this mystery that, you know, everybody can make up their own mind as to where it actually comes from and what it wants, you know. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's there and you don't know what it wants, that nagging question is I think, was looming over like all the characters' life.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is while this space god is out there, there's real life going on underneath it. And at the very beginning, we see a mouse by the name of Nate, and he goes for a job interview.
Right.
And it is one of the most unusual job interviews I've ever seen.
Yes.
Shall we say? Oh, my! It's, you know, he goes there and it's a place, it's called Cheesy Wiggly, which is a combination of a couple of names. And he gets there a little late and the person answering the door says, you know, you're late. And we pride ourselves on punctuality. And then he has to get rid of the drink that he's drinking. And while that's going on, there's something going out in space is happening. So there's all sorts of interesting things going on. It looks like these mice kind of inhabit our world because there's NASA on the helmets and stuff like that of the people.
Yeah,
in space.
It's 100% our world. You know, it's which is the fun of it. So in that sense, I would say when you think of something like Fritz the Cat, you know what I mean, where it clearly is our world, but it's done with animals. So I would say it's probably in that tradition, although it's a completely different voice, but just in terms of the concept of how you handle like the anthropomorphic aspect of it, that's what it is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, of course, things start to happen. There's the girl is in there and she's in this, goes into this meeting. And the first thing they do is be sexist and say, you know, we want tea right now. And she's like, tea? But and then they say, today, sweetheart, they say to her. And she actually goes and gets it for them, which surprised the heck out of me. But it was just
that. Yeah, you know, who knows how you react when you're under, you know, when you're under pressure and everything plays to your insecurities, you know. And then you look back and you're like, why did I do that? And then you kind of hate yourself, but you just couldn't help it in the moment. You know, there's this duo of characters in the center of the book that I really love. It's Nate and Lydia, and they're like foster siblings, right? Mm-hmm. So they grew up. They have this bond that is unbreakable, but at the same time, they are very, very different. She's like an overachiever. She's got this unpaid or low paid internship in this prestigious law firm, where obviously, you know, it's a boys club and all that stuff. And, you know, but she's still kind of hanging in there, you know. And he's like this guy who's been kind of drifting around and he's got this bag with his work in it. You don't quite know what it is. It never shows you, but it just keeps going, bouncing from like entry-level job to entry-level job that he can't quite, you know, hold down, you know. And yet, so that's the slice of life aspect, which is super, super fun. And at the same time, guess what? They seem to find themselves at the center of this giant cosmic conspiracy, you know. So it's a very cognitively dissonant book. It's super fun. There's a lot of humor in it. There's all the fun tropes that you like from those genres. It's kind of like that. It's a as I said, a weird comic for and about weird times.
Well, have you based these characters on people you know, or are they creations of your imagination?
I'm going to say this is the book where most of the characters, except for a certain one that we're not going to spoil who that is, but I think who's a little bit, a little too inspired by real life. But for most of these characters, they're actually not inspired by people that I'm directly related to, which is rare for me because very often in my stories, you know, there's something that feels very, very close to me. Like in Palomino, for instance, the father, daughter, you know, I've raised, you know, two super badass daughters. And, you know, there's something to that relationship that is definitely, very immediate to me, but not in this one. This one is just, it's just trying to walk through the shoes of people that I'm not maybe close to, but that it just feels like you want to walk in these shoes for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you said you made this available at the last Kickstarter. How was that successful? I mean, you made copies of it, and if it wasn't successful, I don't think you'd be doing it again. So the reception was pretty good for this?
Yeah. So actually, Romance in the Age of the Space God was not part of the previous Kickstarter. We just did a small batch before Comic Con, San Diego Comic Con last year, and it sold out like literally in a couple of days, and then we had to reprint another small batch. And so now we are making it an official, because to answer your question, the response has been amazing. And which is funny because it's probably one of the most stylized books that I do because of the anthropomorphic, animals aspect and stuff like that. And yet people feel very connected to it. They feel like, oh my God, this feels so real, so true to life, So the response has been amazing. We got like just a few days ago, an amazing, quote from Mark Waid. The response has been really, really incredible, which is why we're making it now part of this Kickstarter, so that we do like a real wide print edition of it.
So if this goes over well, you have other things you'd like to do in Romance in the Age of a Space God.
Yes, there's a whole big story behind it. There's a whole world. I mean, you can see when you read the. The thing that's fun with short stories is like you kind of open them. It's like a window and you just get this kind of, I call it this story contact high from that world, and you don't, and then you close the window and it's over, but you could feel and really enjoy the presence of that world and your kind of short connection to it. Mm-hmm. But there, it's a big world. And so, it is entirely possible that once I'm done with Palomino, which has one more volume to go, then after that, maybe I'll go back into Romance and we'll explore that big story. But I really work on instinct. Like I rarely know what I'm gonna do until I do it. So we'll see. But it's very possible.
Now, I do have to say that Romance in the Age of a Space God has some big surprises in there, which I didn't expect. And so I want people to go into it and think that it's very, very startling at points. There are certain things that I would not ever spoil because I don't want people to not get the impact that I got out of it. But it's really amazing stuff.
Well, thank you.
And just funny at some points, shocking at other points and stuff. So it's a really good, really interesting story. And I could see this going on for several issues, I bet you, afterwards.
Yeah.
Really good stuff. Well, why don't we jump over to Palomino? Because this is, unfortunately, I did not get to do this one, but I'm going to read some of the stuff that came out in the news release, which I think will help us get an understanding of it. It says, a captivating neo-noir crime mystery, Palomino begins in 1981 Los Angeles with Eddie Lang, an old-school, hard-ass, hard-boiled former Burbank PD detective juggling his six nights a week gig in the Palomino house band, his PI business, and Lizette Lang, his teenage daughter, who might be even more hard-ass and hard-boiled than her dad is. But tragedy looms large over their past, and a brand new case that's hitting a little too close to home upends their lives, sending them down very dangerous paths. Told with action, suspense, humor, drama, and slice of life irony, Palomino 1981 volumes 1-3 takes place at the Palomino Club's high watermark, with Eddie leading the investigation in the Wilcox case. While Palomino 1995 volume 4-6 takes place in the twilight years of the club, with his now adult daughter Liz leading the case and bringing the story to its epic conclusion. Now this, I take it this is not mice. This is people in Palomino,
right?
This is
actual people.
Okay. Now, one thing I do want to mention, I think you did all the art and stuff like that in Romance of the Age of Space God, right?
Yes, I do the art and the writing in all my books.
Okay. So that's the same with this one then. Yeah. How did you differentiate them? Did you, are these just two separate projects that happened to come together in Kickstarter, or? Is there some relationship between them?
No, the relationship is that this is our 2020-25 slate, the two new volumes of Palomino and the Romance in the Age of the Space God. So, when you do independent comics like we do, people like to check back in and see, okay, what's new this year? What's new? What's the new stuff you got? So this is the new crop of books.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a quote in here I think that would be helpful. It says, as Palomino time jumps 14 years, at the beginning of Volume 4, not only do we transition from the club's heyday to its twilight moments, but we also pass the baton from one detective to the next. The world has moved on from the unsolved Eileen Wilcox case, but Lizette, now 29 and going by Liz, hasn't. So when a routine assignment at one of the Valley's free weeklies reopens old wounds and Liz takes it upon herself to revisit the case her father was never able to close, she finds herself entering a world of deception and danger where the only way out is through. I like that stuff. This is going to be a very different book from the Romance in the Age of Space Gods. This is much more of a grounded
mystery. It's very grounded. It's very I mean, I think you described well it starts, two time periods, 1981, 1995. And it's in terms of the groundedness, it is the Palomino Club used to be a real club here in LA. It was like a place where it was a country music club. But also where you could have rock stars, just hanging there. Like you could have a Beatle kind of pop up on stage, unannounced, or, you had like, it was also at the sort of the crossroads of music and the TV world and the whole Valley sort of power structure or whatever. So you could have, John Belushi and Jerry Lee Lewis, getting drunk at the bar together, or you'd have Evel Knievel sitting up front. It was like a really, really amazing place. And I'm a musician myself. And for many, many years, I played in clubs like that. So I didn't play at the Palomino because it closed in 1995 when I arrived in LA, but I did play and became, close to a lot of the musicians from the Palomino and worked with them at other, in other situations, through the years after that. And so having played in clubs since I was 15, there's like a certain texture and a certain vibe to it that I really wanted to capture. And not only that, but I always thought that would be an amazing background for a neo-noir LA crime story. And so that was the origin of Palomino. And it really came together when I had this idea of the father-daughter situation, where, first part of the story, he has the lead and she's a teenager. So as badass as she is, she only has so much agency, right? Because she's a kid. What can she do, right? But then you jump and you love her as a character, but you can feel like the limitations of her position in life. And then you jump 15 years and now she's 29. She has the lead. She's become this. So you took this character that you already loved as a teenager, but now she has all the agency of an adult plus all the baggage that was accrued in between. And she just becomes this really insanely cool noir character that you follow in this final gauntlet where she's going to have to solve the case that her father couldn't or die trying.
Is the father still alive when she starts doing this?
Should I spoil this?
Don't spoil stuff. I'd rather you don't spoil
it. There's a big cliffhanger at the end of the 1981 section, which is the end of the film. So I'm not going to reveal which way.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, I hate spoilers. I like teases, but I don't like spoilers. If I can, I'm going to read a little bit more from this release because it has some interesting stuff in it. It says, writing and drawing the graphic novel series Palomino is Frank's passion project. And then quotes uses, from my years playing club music in clubs to having raised two amazing and quite hard-boiled daughters in Los Angeles, many of my lived experiences converged in Palomino with my absolute passion for noir to create the most personal and lived-in work of my career. At its core, Palomino is about the impermanence of all things we wrongly assume will always be there for us as a society, as a culture, and about how the only thing that truly remains is the moral fiber of individuals passed down from one generation to the next, which really makes me want to read this thing. It really says, interesting.
That's what it is. It's just when everything changes, it's funny because there was a huge ecosystem of music clubs from the 40s to the 1990s in LA, right? With one of my dear friends passed on now, but one of my dear friends, his name was Archie Francis, who was the house drummer at the Palomino and who's played with whoever you can imagine. He's played with them. And, two streets away from me, as luck would have it. And we actually ended up playing a lot of music together, like in his later years. But the point is, back in those days, right, you could have a 6 nights a week gig, you know, in a club like that. And, raise a family, buy a house in LA, have a good middle class life and stuff like that, right? And obviously, those days are well over, you know. And so, in a certain way, we're kind of using the image of the working musician as a canary in the coal mine of what's happened to the American middle class, you know, between the 80s and now. So, mm-hmm. So there's a lot of very lived in, very true to life qualities to the book. And it is very personal in many ways. And the other thing too is when I was a kid, you know, I was reading comics, which I obviously loved, otherwise I wouldn't be doing this. But but I always felt like there was two things that really didn't look right, were cowboy hats and musical instruments. And so I was just like, you know, this is my chance to make it right.
Interesting. Now, there's another thing in here that fascinates me. I don't know if you know who like Jeff Lemire is, creating comics and stuff.
Not only I know who he is, but he actually wrote a great blurb for Palomino on the back of one of the books.
See, yeah. That's great because when I've read all of his stuff, and I had a chance to interview him several years ago. I brought up the same thing that this release talks about. It says there are certain themes that always seem to come in my stories, you said. One of them is family in all its forms, whether it's a father-daughter detective duo or two foster siblings or even a family by choice like in Silver, which was, I think, your first graphic novel. And so he did a lot of that. And he did Animal Man, but Animal Man was kind of the jumping off point. We got to see the whole family around him and stuff like that in that book. And based on what I've read in The Romance in the Age of a Space God, that family is really quite a significant thing as far as, and you know, it's something that most of us can relate to, I think, is having a family and interaction with other people and the families we choose and the families we're born with and stuff like that. And the difference between,
right. Exactly. So
it's just an amazing thing to me. I don't think we have nearly as much discussion about family and focus on it as we should, I think.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's like, you know, when my kids were little, you know, and you know, kids are like, that age where they're like everybody's fighting around the dinner table and stuff like that. As a parent, you can't take it anymore, you know. And I was like, enough. And I was like, listen, guys, one day mom and I will be dead. Mm. And all you will have in the world is each other. Mm. So figure it out. You know what I mean? And then we go, oh, okay. And then, you know, and so the truth is like, to me, the meaning of family, it's like, who's your, like, you know, as the kids said today, your ride or die, right? Like, who's always there for you no matter what? Who will always have your back? And in the world that is very difficult these days, you know, having people who truly have your back, that's a hard thing to find. And when you have it, it's, you should treasure it and you should fight for it and you should, you know. And so to me, that's what's interesting with that's the meaning of family. And as you said, you know, different stories go about it different ways, right? So sometimes it's something that the characters have and then it's theirs to lose or theirs to maintain. Sometimes they don't have it, but they need to gain that, you know, through the story, you know. So it's, and you know, that's the other thing that's super fun in 1981, 1995 kind of switch is that like I was saying earlier, like one of the big breakthrough for me for Palomino was figuring out that it was a father-daughter story. And in the first part of the story, when he's an adult, but, you know, he's a detective in a neo-noir story. So as you can imagine, he himself at some point is borderline, gets, you know, out of control, you know, a little bit, you know. But I think when you're a parent, and especially like he's the sole parent in that situation, he's caught in that tension that I think every parent knows between butting in and giving them space, right? And you know, with the dangers and the necessities of both, right? So that's really is the in terms of the parental story. That's the gist of it in the first part. But then in the second part, it becomes something else. It becomes her story, because there's also a mom in the story that dies way before any of the story actually starts. So she looms in the story. And the thing with having lost a parent at an early age, and that's part of my story, is that, you know, especially if you lost, you know, a parent before you were old enough to really be able to know them as a person, then they're a little bit of a mystery to you, right? They're like their lore, their unreliable narration from somebody else, whoever tells you about them, right? But they're essentially a mystery to you, and the part of you that is them is also a mystery. So you'll also be a mystery to yourself, you know, to a certain degree, until you figure it out and get past it. So that's something that is coming from my own life. But that's the second half of the story from her point of view. So just being able to tell that parental story from both sides, I thought was just really exciting for me.
Well, it really sounds interesting because, you're challenging the comics industry on some levels. The Space God one is a short story, although, you know, you said there might be more to come. Palomino is a story in sections. I got to talk a little bit about this. It says the Kickstarter will feature copies of all five available volumes of Palomino, as well as Palomino 1981 box sets, slipcases, and signed book plates. And so, from that, I guess you have finished the first five volumes.
Yes, I'm already into the five. It's going to be six altogether, so I'm already in process on number six right now.
Oh wow! Okay, so do you have any idea when that's going to be complete?
It's going to be in about a year. Between the time that it's fully done and released and it'll be about a year, but it won't be as long as some of the times, because the book's already written, it's already laid out. I just have to do the final art on it, which takes months, but not years. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I always say that writers have an easy go of it because they can write "the building exploded" and that takes up a whole page, but then the artist has to draw that and that could take weeks.
So true.
So I always have to, I respect both aspects of it. But yeah. So you're in this Kickstarter, you're able to order the five. Are you able to pre-order the six, volume six?
Not yet, because I do the Kickstarters when the books are already done. So that way people don't have to wait, you know, like a year or two, you know, before they get it, right? So if you order the Kickstarter, you know, pretty much by the time the campaign's over, the stuff ships to the printer, and then it just becomes, you know, within just a short few months, you have it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do your daughters help out in any of this stuff, or is this largely your project?
No, actually, my brother too, by the way, but my sisters and I collaborate actually on other projects. On this project, my wife does the flat coloring, so she's doing all that heavy lifting, which I would not have the time to do, you know, so that's great.
Well, it's hard to do everything in there. It's funny because this makes me think of there's another mouse book that I like real well called Mouse Guard. And David Peterson, who does that, does everything, except just recently he turned the art duties over to somebody else. And he used to, he jokingly would tell me he would have to do these interviews like with me and stuff like that, just so people knew he was still alive, because it took him so long to do all this stuff.
And he's a proof of life.
He does. What he does too is he'll have sessions online where he does artwork, and you can watch him do the artwork online, which is a nice thing for him, because you know that gives him a chance for people to see and stuff like that. Do you do anything like that, or do you kind of keep that private?
I've been thinking about doing stuff like that because I really like that. For one thing, everything I've learned, artistically, I've learned it from other people, watching them work or working with them, And so I really like that concept. So like, for instance, in the, I usually pay a lot of attention to the back material, in my books, And so Palomino, it's a different thing because it's so grounded in the real world that it's a lot of interviews of real people that were connected to the real Palomino in one way or another. So that's a different vibe. But for my for Silver, which was the previous graphic novel, long series I did before Palomino, every book had like some very sort of thorough process stuff in the back. And what I mean by process, sometimes, let's be honest, they slap a couple of sketches together and then they call it process. No, like in this case, it's really like quite a bunch of pages of me going through the pages, showing the layouts, the inks, explaining why certain choices are made or why did I change them from layout to final because maybe there was a better solution or it told the story better. So there's a lot on the process in the real way, like a real conversation on the story, on storytelling. So I do a lot of that stuff. I also do, we just announced just a few days ago, CTN Expo, has some scholarships, mostly in animation, but there is one in comics. So I'm doing the scholarship. And so, which includes various perks that people are getting, but also working with me, with critiques and mentoring and stuff like that. So I do a lot of that stuff, and I always love to, I'm not at all protective of showing my tricks or whatever, I think it's, there's nothing to gain. And anytime the thing that's magic to me in storytelling, whether it's like if I'm working on a movie or whatever, and we do a screening for somebody, or now it's on TV and I watch it with somebody else, it's like whenever you screen the movie, you see, no matter how much you worked on it, you see it completely differently through the eyes of the person you're sitting with. And I feel like it's the same with the books, right? Like whenever I'm at a comic book convention and I see someone flipping through the pages, every time now I'm seeing the book differently from through the eyes of that person somehow. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why I digressed in that direction, but it has to do with the fact that that anytime I show process to people, anytime I explain something or teach something or whatever, I feel like I'm learning new things, and just by virtue of me explaining something I know just makes me realize like, hey, wait a minute, I don't know about this and this, or like, oh, now it all makes sense. You know what I mean? So I think it's a win-win process for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, it helps everybody because you might share some knowledge that inspires somebody to do something else or go a different direction anyway. So now, I cannot let you go without asking about your involvement with one of my all-time favorite, absolutely love it to pieces, animated movie, and that was The Iron Giant.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my twin brother and I, for 4 Saturday nights in a row, there was a theater that was showing it, and we went every Saturday night to watch it again because we could not get enough of it. And that movie, the notion of what if a gun had a soul, just, it just grabbed me, and I watched everything I could watch about it. And then when I, like I said, when I saw the movies, I saw the movie several times. I still to this day, every once in a while, if I'm in the mood for something really good, I pull up The Iron Giant and watch that again, because it just, you know, I guess I was a kid in that kind of that era with a bicycle along those lines and stuff like that. And with the when the robot shows up, and then in the end, everything just goes nuts. I was into that movie like crazy, and I still am. Yeah. It's part of me wishes they would do another Iron Giant, like an Iron Giant 2, but part of me does not, because that first one was so, it was a perfect movie. It was terrific. What did you do with that? What was your involvement with that?
I was one of the supervising animators on the movie, meaning that, animators, in the movie are organized in teams, and depending on how the movie is organized, you could be in charge of a character, in charge of a sequence, whatever. So as a supervising animator, I was in charge of the animation in certain sequences of the movie.
Mm. Gosh, I loved it. I, to this day, it still is. It's the thing by which I measure all other animation. Is this good animation? Does it measure up to Iron Giant? Well, if it does, it's really good. If it doesn't, not so much. But that movie, I saw they added some new sequences to it. My roommate and I went to see it when it came out, and we were just like, I loved even the extra ones to me. I'm trying to find a copy of the stuff with the new stuff added in so I can have that. Because,
the new sequence is a sequence that was actually storyboarded back then. Mm-hmm. But then, the studio didn't want to pay for that extra sequence. So it ended up not being produced. But, now it has been,
Because, I don't think that movie ever got the adulation and the praise that it should have gotten. A lot of people really loved it. And if I ever go online and say how much I love The Iron Giant, I get a whole host of people coming, yes, what a great movie. But I think there was a lot more that people just, because it was animated for some crazy reason, they just didn't get into it.
But I mean, I'll tell you, for all these years that I've been doing conventions, people come to my table, just announcing that, hey, I know you for The Iron Giant, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And just to tell me that, in other words, if I had a nickel for every person who told me that's their favorite movie, I could literally pay for the sequel myself. I'm telling you, it's out there, and people, it's a lot more present in the culture than you would believe, but also because it's a movie that really found its audience on home video. If you knew how many people told me that they had it as a VHS tape and they worn it out, and then they had another one, and then they had to get a DVD, and they get, so there's like a very private. It ended up being a very private, and talk about, we were talking about family earlier. It ended up being a very, very private family experience and kind of shared moment for a lot of people, it's wonderful,
It was a spectacular movie. I knew I was going to like it when I saw the previews and stuff for it. But then when I went and actually saw it, I came out of there just going like, holy mackerel, what a great movie. My brother and I, if it was in a theater, we went and saw it because it was there for a month, and we saw it every Saturday night we could go and see it because it was just an amazing film. So it was just great stuff like that. Well, it makes me want to read your other stuff more because, classic, fantastic movie.
And also the thing is too, it was also fairly early in my career. So it was first and foremost an amazing kind of learning experience in there. I feel like so much of what I've learned about, anything from animation to directing and all that stuff, it's come from that movie.
Wow. Well, Let me tell you, it was a great movie to get a start on because it's still ultra classic to me. It is one of those films that I think about every once in a while, and I have to go and pull it out and watch it because it reminds me so much of what a great story it was. And then the end, I shouldn't go on and on about it, but the end when the bump in his head changes and things all go nuts. I remember just sitting there gasping. It was just such a terrific, terrific movie. Just surprises. And then the very, very end, which I won't spoil, which all kinds of interesting things are going on. And I just, that's like I said, I wish they would make an Iron Giant 2, but part of me says, no, this is good enough. Don't spoil it. You know, I'm always afraid somebody would get a hold of it. Because like when Disney would make movies, like they did The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which I absolutely adored. And then they did a second one, and it was absolutely everything I did not want the first one to be. And so I'm always, sometimes when something's really good, let it alone. It's really
Let it be. Let it be.
It's terrific. So that was, I was about that one. So anyway, it's Romance in the Age of the Space God, as well as Palomino, 1981 and 1995. And it's on Kickstarter, so be sure to get out there and support it so we can get more of this great stuff. And Stefan, it's really wonderful stuff. I got to get a hold of Palomino. I have to back that and get those books because really looks terrific.
Wow, that's awesome. Thank you so much.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support this show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance. And that's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.